Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Well, good morning, New York City, with Bruce Frankel, author of the book, What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life? How are you this morning, Bruce?
I'm great, Zara. How are you?
I just couldn't be better, you know. April Fool's Day is almost on the horizon, and being a kid that grew up in Catholic schools, I can't wait to pull the pranks that I love to pull. But at any rate, well, how are book sales going?
I think they're going okay. I don't honestly have any reports, but what I do have is great feedback from people. I gave a talk last week to an AARP group in Rockland County, and the response was great. So
that's wonderful. For those who are listening and may not be familiar with Bruce's work, his book, What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life, is all over the charts, including being highly recommended by AARP as a must-read. Bruce took the opportunity at an own break in his own career frenzy to go and interview very talented individuals, 60 and over, and how they have jettisoned their lives to the next level. You know, Bruce, this week when you and I were chatting about, so what do we delve into this weekend, you had mentioned, you know, based on your own reflection, this is after writing your book, you had really kind of skirted the whole issue of what really does success look like, or what is it? And now you're finding that inquiry kind of bombarding you through your own reading, aren't you?
Yeah, no, I definitely am. It was a puzzle to me. I must say that when I began writing What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life, the very first question when I went in search of people I asked, when I was looking for people, I wanted people who had succeeded in some way that was significant, I said when I was in search of people. And the responses I got from people varied. Many people who I was asking to point me in the direction of someone, they were concerned about the word success, what does success mean, and I kind of blew by it, to be honest. I felt like I knew what I wanted, and I'd find it when I saw it. But as I went on in the process, I began to wonder what really does constitute success. Where do people find what does success really mean? And I realized that, to a degree, that one of the things I realized eventually was that success is a construct. It doesn't really exist any more than the weather exists. You know, we there are certain components of success that we believe are there, or we believe are part of what makes up success. But our notions of what success are probably vary greatly from person to person.
Yes.
But one of the things that really began to strike me is that we tend to be taught that success is this attainable thing, as in an object almost, and that we have a culture that kind of worships success.
Yes.
We have lots of books that have sold millions and more copies based on the notion that success is a attainable thing. When, you know, we adorn the idea of success, we embellish it just as we do our bodies with jewelry or clothing or styles, and our houses with objects, trying to make it more and more tangible. When in fact, success isn't really based on those things, and it isn't as tangible, and that what it is really very different than what we are trained to think of it. And as a result, I think one of the things that happens in life is we're surprised when something occurs and throws us away from what we believe is success, and we feel betrayed in some way. Which, so that
well, you know, and one thing we might what tuned me into what you're saying here was my own life experiences of, I can remember, you know, the flurry and the push to wrap up all my undergraduate studies and take those last round of final exams, right? And the boxes were starting to be packed, you know, at my sorority house to move home for a period of weeks and then travel before I took my first job. And, you know, the big excitement around graduation and the whole bit. And yet, when you got there, it's sort of like there was this huge balloon that popped, or, and I don't want to say post-success letdown, but in some regards it was like, okay, I'm here now, but, and it wasn't that thrill invigoration. Now, certainly graduation was a lot of fun, but the aftershock of saying, okay, this was just one point on a series of points that you were going to take.
Yeah, and that, you know, you know, we're trained to see, say, when we're in school and we're kids, we're taught good grades are success.
Oh, yeah.
We come to believe that that's the definition of success. Or later we may see getting a promotion or owning a home or having money in the bank or being elected to office. Mm-hmm. That these are the hallmarks of success. When in fact, success is really what I came to see through the people in What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life, and indeed in what I saw in my own writing of the book, what I learned through my own writing of the book, was that success isn't a thing at all. Mm-hmm. It's a way of being, and it's a way of being aligning ourselves with our values and pursue that. That it is an unintended side effect of one's, this is a quote actually from Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, the Austrian psychologist who was a Holocaust survivor. And he wrote that we shouldn't aim at success, that the more you aim at it and make it a target, the more you are going to miss it.
Miss it, yeah.
For success, like happiness, cannot be pursued. It must ensue as the unintended side effect of one's personal dedication to a course greater than oneself.
Yeah, a course greater than oneself. And of course, that can bring a lot of fear, high expectations, or real stretch, right?
Yeah, it absolutely can. And I think that you're right to underline that, because, you know, what... And I think I would probably play with that myself, based on what I learned from the people in my book, in that notion of what's greater than oneself has a very is malleable. So in one wonderful example in my book, Loretta Thayer, who is a farmer's wife most of her life, raised a great family. Her husband died, and after 9/11, she wanted to do something. When 9/11 occurred, she felt impelled to do something to help. She didn't know what that was. She didn't know how she could help. She lives up near the border of the Canadian-New York border.
Right.
And she ultimately decided to open up this diner that had defunct diner where she had been a waitress 50 years earlier, to create a place of for good food and good fellowship, as she put it. Now, that's a goal greater than oneself. She succeeded, but she didn't succeed in terms of, you know, making millions of dollars. Her success is constituted by what happened in the community around her.
Exactly.
So, you know, and really, the other thing is, when I was very conscious of this last week when I spoke at this AARP meeting, you know, what's greater than oneself can be as, not as small, but as close as the person who you live with. Mm-hmm. You know, or your child, or your parent, or what you do for your neighbor. You know, the way in which you engage in the world, the way in which you, so that it's not all about me, obviously.
Yes, exactly. Well, you know, nonetheless, I'm sure people are always looking for, and this might be, obviously, Bruce, the seeds of a new book for you, right? Almost like you set on the destination to write, what should I do with the rest of my life, thinking you knew what success was, and then the gift that you had gotten from the stories of these individuals, how it's now shaping your own thinking as you continue your own journey. But those thoughts of, so what might that template look like? I think we have to be careful of calling it a recipe, because then in our culture, it's the instant success, right? I'll go and check the boxes, check, 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 and then, whoop, I got it. But what might be that template that could help people get their arms around this bigger topic you're suggesting?
Well, I mean, you know, what I've been thinking about, and for me, the beginning starts with the notion of curiosity, mm-hmm. to be honest. And I always come back to that, because I believe that we're most engaged and most empowered by doing what fires our imagination, what resonates with us, with what's aligned with what we love. And if we start there and we set our compass to move forward and positively forward, you know, it's critical. And so is, you know, having mindful goals, so mm-hmm. that the goals are not, I think goal setting and self-discipline to realize goals. There's a book I've been reading by Martin Seligman called Flourish, which is just about to come out, and he talks about the critical importance of self-discipline in satisfaction and happiness. That it turns out that self-discipline, when looked at scientifically, is probably the best predictor of happiness.
You bet.
I saw it in the people that I looked at that are make up the stories of my book. That self-discipline came from within because they were doing what they loved. So then self-discipline became easier. And so it's a reinforcing cycle. You do what you love, you gain self-discipline, you move forward towards happiness, and, you know, you appreciate yourself. And that allows you to appreciate and engage with others. And that's also, I think, one of the most critical components. It's how we both view ourselves and how we acknowledge what has gone right in our lives and what is good in our lives. You know, studies do show that when you can only see the negative, you're in big trouble. There's a Seligman writes about, there's a study that was done, that there are actually a few of them that look at something called the Lozado scale, which is when you tell, when you look at the statements people make in corporations. One study looked at the statements that 50 companies, people within a company made. When the positive statements compared to negative statements fell below a 2.9-to-1 ratio,
mm-hmm,
that
right.
company did not succeed. The ratio has to be higher than 2.9-to-1. And in marriages, John Gottman, out at the Love Lab in the University of Washington, put the ratio in marriages about, I think, at 5-to-1 was the threshold. Anything below 5-to-1, marriages were likely to fail. And so language and how we view ourselves becomes part of how we actually create the environment for what we'll call success.
Absolutely. And then there's sort of like the positive magnets that keep pulling you forward. Well, I think companies or any of us, if we get into a situation and we now are looking at it in hindsight, if we go at it with the, okay, lessons learned, or even the word post-mortem, you know, kind of tells you something died and now we're going to figure out why it went wrong, as opposed to we don't spend perhaps sufficient time celebrating, so how was it that we did all those things right? And then build from an appreciation appreciative way. You know, the words appreciative inquiry or positive psychology of building and bolstering. Now, some people would call it, well, you Pollyannas, you run around and operate in life that way. And we say, yes, we do. And that's why we're going with the direction that we are.
Well, I mean, that you hit on, I mean, what you said is very important, particularly the notion of how we celebrate what we do. You know, as it goes for everything from being parents to being bosses to how we view our own accomplishment. If we don't appropriately recognize and attend to those moments of accomplishment, we're really doomed. I mean, we can't. Creativity comes out of that place of belief that's fostered through these acts of recognition.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And those are acts of recognition as well, as you would say. Let's talk about the random acts of kindness, humanity, engagement, how we choose to, you know, treat our fellow human beings.
I think that you know, again, lots of studies have shown now that, say, longevity is the more you volunteer, the likelier it is that you're going to live a long life. There are a number of studies. Well, there's a reason, I think, for these, that these things get borne out by science. If people begin actually volunteering, studies have shown that when people begin volunteering, even once a month when they're in their 20s, the likelihood of living a healthy, long life is much greater. So it comes down to a sense of well-being, which is what Seligman writes about in his new book, as really the goal, that, you know, it isn't that we should volunteer because we want something back. It's because of what the transaction of helping others does for everyone,
exactly.
For ourselves,
yep.
For our community, for others, and, you know, just creating a better environment where, you know, we're better off if others succeed, and it makes it our chances of succeeding in life greater as well.
And again, you know, this is back to, you know, our sort of our question of the day. So what does success look like? What you've laid out really is, you know, some might call it a recipe, others a form in which other things could take shape. But this idea of longevity in the mix of it for this total well-being, I mean, our last segment, Bruce, one of them, you talked about the absolute criticality for exercise, for everything from high cardio to yoga to meditation. It's to keep us, you know, in a balanced way, watching for those, you know, unintended positive side effects, I call it, even within ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that recently studies have shown, for instance, that, and I add yoga more and more to my thinking on this, I believe we're meant to move, and again, studies show the importance of that, that in order to do all these things, we have to keep our bodies in shape and flowing in our brain, and there is, I think, actually a kind of relationship between our ability to make our bodies flow in some way, and our ability to flow towards doing things. You know, action is really what it all comes down to. It doesn't happen just in contemplation. But, you know, I add, as I said, yoga more and more because recent studies have shown, for instance, that meditating about 30 minutes a day, 27 minutes, I think, was the number, increases the density of the hippocampus, which is the memory
exactly.
part of the brain,
exactly.
and decreases the density of gray matter in the amygdala, which is the emotional part of us, where we become reactive to
exactly.
things.
Exactly, and particularly the reactive distress. Well, Bruce, thank you, as always, for kicking off our show in a great space. A reminder to our listeners to look up www.brucefrankel.com to learn more about his works, his thoughts, his future writings, as well as his current book that's out there, What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life? Thanks a lot, Bruce. Have a great upcoming month, April Fools and all, and I'll talk to you next month.
Thank you, Zara. Have a great day.
We will.
Be well.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll-free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, 877-544-2580.